Hello, baseball fans, and welcome back to the fifth, Matt, fifth?
Yeah, I think the fifth?
I'm not really sure. The fifth edition of the MLB Daily Dish podcast, the Roster Rhetorical? Sure, we're going to go with fifth. We may sound like idiots by the time this is over, but we're going to go with five. Our guest today is another SB Nation writer for Beyond the Box Score. Nick Stellini joins us. Nick, how are you today?
Good, how are you guys?
We're good. You picked a good day to come on the show because we got a lot of things to cover today. So good on you to accept our offer to be on the show this week.
Yeah, the baseball gods kind of threw some stuff into our laps.
Yeah, we have a lot of things to get to. So, Matt, I'll let you decide. Which managerial decision should we start with?
Why don't we lead off with Mattingly, since the Marlins are by far more interesting.
Okay, yeah, that's fair. The Marlins are always seem to be the team that everyone likes to talk about. So, yeah, Don Mattingly, in probably what's not a surprise, since it's been reported since he left the Dodgers, even a little bit before he left the Dodgers, he is going to be the next manager of the Miami Marlins. Vice Sports broke the story, Molly Knight. It's a four-year deal. And, guys, this is the eighth manager that the team has had since 2010, and we've only played 5 years. So that's I think, the big takeaway here is that they're on another manager. And do we think it's a good hire?
I mean, my big thing with Mattingly has always been that his bullpen management has been suspect. And it's easy to, I think, exacerbate the degree to which his bullpen management is questionable because he didn't really have much of a bullpen to work with in LA. So he didn't really have a whole lot of good answers. And the Marlins bullpen has always actually kind of been underrated in a way. I mean, AJ Ramos, Morris, and Dunn at the back is fairly all right. And they've got some other guys in the DL too. But I mean, at the same time, I mean, do you want to start placing bets on how long he stays there?
Sure. What do you got? You
I mean,
thought about this?
I've been thinking about it as I drove around this morning. But I mean, it's Jeff Loria, so you never know how long these guys are going to stay. And the rest of the front office is kind of weird too. David Sampson's a weird guy, from what I understand. So, I mean, he could be gone in a year or two, and I don't think anybody would bat an eye.
Here's the interesting thing, Matt, and the fact of the matter is Dan Jennings may or may not still be the general manager. You know, Jeffrey Loria has seemed to be conducting all of these managerial interviews, and Jennings hasn't been in the room. And a lot of people have tried to put the pieces together as to what this means, and it might mean that Loria is trying to make Jennings leave on his own and not have to fire him. But let's play that story out and say that Jennings goes one way or another and Loria brings in a new general manager. That general manager is going to have to get along with Mattingly, and we know in sports, baseball, football, whatever it may be, that a general manager likes to pick the person on the field running the team. And a general manager is going to have to come into a situation where Mattingly's already here and they're going to have to get along, and that sometimes doesn't always work.
Yeah, that's definitely not ideal, at least from the general manager's position. But I feel like anyone who takes a position with the Marlins just kind of knows that they don't really have full control, or at least as much control as a general manager like Bobby Evans or Brian Cashman, that at the end of the day, there's always that one move you could make or that one move you don't make that's going to cost you your job.
I'm just perplexed as to why Loria just doesn't run the team himself. I think we were talking in the MLB Daily Dish chat yesterday, Matt, about this. You know, if it could make things a lot easier on everybody involved if Loria just wanted to take control as a general manager.
Yeah, and I know Bates and I were talking about whether or not that's actually allowed. He pointed out that owners aren't permitted to manage their own team, so there might be something there that prevents Loria from pulling a Jerry Jones, but you'd think it would just be easier if he was the GM, at least from an outside perspective.
And, yeah, you know, I also wonder, you know, how much he is the GM without actually being the GM, you know what I mean?
Fair.
Because, I mean, Jennings was his guy, Mike Hill is his guy, Sampson is his guy, and And a big part of what we've heard about the Marlins front office for a long time is loyalty to Loria. So he might be pulling strings without actually being in the room. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, he could very easily just have a guy be there as a figurehead, and he's making the final decisions. I mean, that's very likely, especially with what we know about Loria and some of the things that have happened over the last couple of years. But back to Mattingly, the big thing for him is he's going to go from a Dodgers team that he has put in the playoffs year after year with a ton of talent to now a team that is a little bit on the younger side, and he's going to have to manage young prospects and get them playing at a high level. You know, he's going to have Stanton, who's going to be, you know, the core of this team, the leader of that team. But he's going to have to manage Jose Fernandez, Christian Yelich, you know, Ozuna, because that was a train wreck all year round. So it's a different job for Mattingly now here in Miami. He's going to have to manage young players, not the way he ran things in LA, and you wonder if he's the right guy to do that.
I think part of the reason Mattingly took the job down here was because I think the egos that were going through the Dodgers clubhouse was always something that grated on him, because we've heard on and off that Mattingly's a fairly easygoing guy most of the time, and so dealing with what was going on in the LA clubhouse surely had to be grating on him, especially with the LA media market too. Miami doesn't have as much of a media market. It's a younger club, as you said. And you don't really hear a whole lot about ego problems in the Miami clubhouse. I'm sure that was very appealing to Mattingly.
Well, there are really maybe two downsides to having to go to Miami. One, you don't have Zach Greinke and Clayton Kershaw. And two, ultimately, you have to answer to Jeffrey Loria. And in L.A., they kind of let Don Mattingly do his own thing. And that might not be the case in Miami. And that might be something he has to balance. But he's going to a place that really doesn't have a ton of expectations. Every year in L.A., he was expected to take this team to the World Series. And it just didn't happen. You know, things got in the way. The bullpen wasn't as strong. They didn't have top-tier starting pitching after Greinke and Kershaw. The offense was hit or miss sometimes. So he's going to a Miami team that is still young, still not expected to, you know, go out and win the pennant next year. But they can turn some heads if they add some pieces this winter in an NL East that is suspect. I mean, you know, the Mets are in the World Series, but you don't know what they're going to look like next year. The Nats were a train wreck last year. You hope that their managerial decision, which we're going to get to next, changes them around. So for Mattingly, it's a shot in the dark, but it's not a bad one.
No, I mean, this could be a good thing for him in the end. It's at the end of the day, it's about how Jeff Loria feels about it. But like you said, I mean, you made a lot of good points that this is something he can kind of relax in as long as he stays on Jeff Loria's good side.
Yeah. All right, well, I mentioned them, so we might as well get to them. The Nationals have found their manager as well. They found the announcement from the Washington Post, I believe, was released last night during the World Series that the Nationals have made the decision, in my opinion, that was better than the two options they were looking at. They went with Bud Black over Dusty Baker, and we can discuss that. Bud Black used to manage the Padres. He was there about half of the year, a little bit less than half the year there this year. He was there for 8 years, and things did not go well in San Diego this year. But Bud Black is going to a place where he's got some talent, and he can make things happen. So do you guys like the hire?
Yeah, I definitely do, especially when you consider that the other option was Dusty Baker. I'm not sure how he got as far as he did in that interview process. I would have been really worried about the Nationals if Rizzo had gone with that. But Bud Black is, I think, the way to go. He was 32-33 as manager of the Padres this year, and then Pat Murphy wound up taking the almost essentially the same team, 42-55. So I think that, if anything, just underscores how good of a job Black was doing in San Diego, and that AJ Preller should have, you know, been applauding his efforts rather than pushing the firing button.
Yeah, Black is a very laid back guy. I actually had the chance to cover the Padres in spring training this year for school, so I was out there with him when they, you know, they had all these guys there. You know, they had Kemp, they had Shields, Will Myers, they were all there. And he's just a laid-back guy. He likes to have fun. And I think that's what the Nationals need right now. They need a guy who's willing, you know, can push the right buttons and be strict at times, but is willing to be laid back and let the guys do their thing.
Yeah, I agree. This is the right hire for the Nationals. they need a laid back guy, but somebody who can also rein stuff in, given the presence of Bryce Harper. And I'm a Bryce Harper apologist, but he just seems to get other guys going. And so having Bud Black there is a good idea. He's also a good manager. And the Nationals need a good manager. The division, like you said, is largely up for grabs next year. You don't know what the Mets are going to do in the offseason, and the Nationals already have a lot of good talent in place. I also think that hiring him is a good idea, not only because he was a pitcher, but Dusty Baker is death to pitchers, and they still have Stephen Strasburg there. They're going to have Lucas Giolito coming up. Joe Ross looks pretty good, and we all know what Dusty Baker did to Kerry Wood and Mark Pryor. So I was very shocked that he was in the running for that job.
Yeah, Black is a pitcher's manager, if in that sense, is he manages his guys well and he knows when to get them out of games. And I think and I don't know how much stock or value you can put on this, but when they've brought in Bud Black, when they head into the free agency in the winter meetings, they have a guy that they can sell to guys that they want to bring in, because they have a lot of holes to fill. Denard Span, Ian Desmond, Jordan Zimmermann are free agents. They're going to try to trade Drew Storen and Jonathan Papelbon, so they're going to need to bring guys in, and Rizzo's going to sell Bud Black to these players and say, hey, look, you know, we know it's not Matt Williams this time around, it's Bud Black, he's well-respected, you know, he's good, and I'm sure Black is going to meet with some of these guys and be like, hey, you know what, come here, you know, we're going to do good things, and that's going to help the Nationals sort of make sure that they're able to get their roster back to where it was.
And I've got actually a little bit of news I just saw on Twitter. Andy Green will be named the next manager of the Padres. He's currently D-backs third base coach. He's an infielder by trade when he played.
So there you go. New things always break while we're on the show, and we always miss them. So this is why we have you, Nick. You can get things for us. So the Padres have found their guy. So I'm looking at it now. The Phillies, the Mariners, the Marlins, the Padres, and the Nats have all filled their managers. That's five teams.
Yeah, I think so.
And then you still have the Dodgers who need somebody.
Yes, they're still going. Gabe Kapler's a name I've heard a lot there. I don't know if they're going to end up going with him. But
Matt, that's five teams already this winter that have gotten rid of a manager and gotten a new one. It's quite a lot.
Yeah, I think going into the year we all thought that, you know, there could have been this much turnover, and there was even more. If you go back to the beginning of the year, the Brewers fired their guy. And, you know, you wonder if Ron Renicki might be in the running for the Dodgers spot too, especially now that Bud Black is off the table. I know that Gabe Kapler is still maybe considered the front runner, but there's always been the Ron Renicki conspiracy theories since he joined the Dodgers. I want to say in late August or maybe early August. I can't remember when he got hired there.
It's interesting because I don't think if we did this podcast earlier in the year, and I told you guys that the Dodgers, the Padres, and the Nationals would be looking for managers this winter, I don't think any of you would have believed me. I mean, that's the type of year that these three teams have had.
The Padres wouldn't have shocked me a whole lot. I was never a big fan of the AJ Preller plan. But there's a lot of turnover. And in a way, it might be good for the sport in the end because just new ideas and stuff, and I like to see new people in the manager's chair. There's not a whole lot of diversity in the hires going around, but that's another topic. I don't know a whole lot about Andy Green either, but yeah, there's a lot of new stuff happening.
All right. Well, moving from the manager's spot to the GM position, there's some interesting news happened this morning that it shocked me at least. And I don't know, I'll get to if it shocked you guys, but Alex Anthopoulos, the Blue Jays general manager, has turned down an extension offer and is leaving the team. Now, his contract expires on Saturday, so he still is with the team through Saturday. But he's going to move on, and that's just interesting because you thought that the only way he would leave the Blue Jays would be that they didn't want him back. You know, at the trade deadline, he changed the Blue Jays, for a lack of a better word, better sense. Troy Tulowitzki, David Price, Ben Revere, you know, all those guys brought in, changed the team. They made the playoffs. They were in the ALCS. You thought that if he was going to stay unless they didn't want him, so it's interesting that he is leaving.
Yeah, although it kind of seemed similar to the Don Mattingly situation where, although they didn't get as far as Toronto did apparently, in that the Dodgers never formally offered an extension to Mattingly, there was a report out there that said that the first and only meeting between Shapiro and Anthopoulos and his front office staff, Shapiro scolded everyone in the room for trading so many of their top prospects away this year to acquire Price and Tulowitzki. So it, at least from the start, and really their only exchange in the couple months that they've both, you know, been with the Blue Jays in some capacity, the only meeting did not go well. And I'm sure that had a lot to do with Anthopoulos maybe wanting to leave, because as you said, it seemed like a foregone conclusion that he was going to be back in 2016 at the very least with the year that he put together here.
Yeah, this was very weird. And the basis of the disagreement at the meeting was supposedly about him trading away his prospects at the trade deadline to get Price and Tulowitzki and all those other guys. That's silly to me. Mark Shapiro should know better than that, because he took a team that was hovering around 500 and they won the division with those moves. And it's not like Troy Tulowitzki was a rental. He's going to be there for a while. That's a piece that they have in place for a while now. And they didn't. And at the end of the day, they didn't give up a whole lot to get Troy Tulowitzki. I mean, they gave up Jeff Hoffman and Miguel Castro, but they still have a lot of good prospects kicking around in that system. So it's not like the farm is empty now. So that was very strange to me. And if that's going to be the working relationship between Alex Anthopoulos and Mark Shapiro, I don't blame him for leaving.
I just wonder now, if Anthopoulos knew he was going to leave this entire time, why wouldn't he have left a little earlier? Now, I know it's only been, you know, a week, but there are a lot of teams that have filled their GM gigs. You know, you thought maybe he would put some feelers out there, even behind the scenes, to maybe put himself in a position to have a new job.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously that's a good point, but we don't know how, you know, what Anthopoulos' desires are. You know, at the moment, Ben Cherington's going to go off and teach a course at a master's program for Columbia University in their sport management program. And both of those guys are at the level where they could just take off as much time as they want, come back a year or two from now and just say, hey, I want another front office position. What can you offer me? And they would, you know, have no problem getting work. It might not be as GM of a team, depending on when they want to come back, but there's so many other front office positions now in baseball that I'm sure they'd be just fine.
And they're both also young guys. And with the creation of the president of baseball ops position that a lot of teams are doing, where they're making that the oversight position and then installing a GM under that, I'm sure a lot of teams are going to continue that trend, and Cherington and Anthopoulos are both guys that could slip into those positions fairly easily.
You just wonder now what the Blue Jays do.
Yeah, because Paul Beeson isn't exactly a baseball guy, and my understanding was that Shapiro wasn't going to have a ton of baseball stuff to do in Toronto, and that was going to be more Anthopoulos' area.
Well,
I thought Shapiro was going to be more of a business area. I could be wrong on that, Matt, if you said something, saw something contrary to that.
No, I want to say I maybe saw the same or a similar tweet that I think you're referring to, that at least, you know, from an outside perspective, it looked like Shapiro is going to be more involved in the business side of having the president of baseball operations role rather than, you know, the role that Andrew Friedman might have, where he's working on all facets of the scouting, you know, drafting process and constructing the major league roster.
Chris Cotillo wrote that this morning, that Shapiro was expected to be more the business side of things.
That's probably where I'm getting it from.
So, but now with Anthopoulos gone, he may have to step in and be, you know, the president of baseball operations and run the team and install a general manager under him. I mean, that seems to be very likely.
Yeah, and you know, there are obviously some other candidates available that didn't get hired for the various positions that were open. So if that is the route that the Blue Jays want to go, they definitely have more than a few candidates to interview.
All right, I've tried to put this off for as long as I possibly could for today's show, but we have to talk about the World Series. And there are three games coming up, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and the New York Mets trail the Kansas City Royals 2-0, and they are going home hoping to survive and bring the series back to Kansas City. So, guys, I'll bring it to you guys because you are outsiders to this, because I know for me it has been 2 days of just pain. So for you, how has the World Series been? Have you enjoyed it?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, game one, just as a fan, I don't think you could have asked for a better game one. 14 innings to start off the Fall Classic is not a bad way to go, and game two is exciting. Obviously, not for the same reasons that game one was, but you know, it was a close game there for most of the action last night, and then the Royals just really pulled away there at the end.
Yeah, game one was the Chris Young Bartolo Colon throwdown we were all hoping for, and it was a good game. But game two, Johnny Cueto morphed back into the good version of Johnny Cueto, and I mean that's why the Mets lost last night. I mean they got beat, and when Johnny Cueto's on, he's very hard to hit around. And Lucas Duda got two kind of seeing eye bloop balls, and that was it. So the Mets definitely have a lot of work to do. But they got to feel good going back home.
There is optimism to be had here. And the fact that they're coming home, they have Noah Syndergaard against Yordano Ventura, which on paper is probably a good matchup for them. And then the question is, who's going to pitch game four? Are they going to go with Chris Young after he threw 50, 60 pitches a couple days ago? You know, that's going to be interesting. And the Mets would have Steven Matz in that scenario, and you'd like their chances there. And then they'd have Matt Harvey looming in a game five, if they could push it there. And Matt Harvey is a pretty good pitcher. So there's not all doom and gloom for Mets fans, but my Twitter feed is full of it, and I understand it, and it's going to be really interesting to see them make the adjustment. And I actually talked about this on the Amazing Avenue podcast last night, which was a very somber experience, but you wonder if the Mets are going to have to change their approach pitching-wise, because it just seems that when the Royals get to two strikes, they're just locked in. They just know what they're doing. And you just wonder if guys like DeGrom and Harvey and Syndergaard, who were strikeout guys, throw it past you, get swings and misses, have to change their approach just a little bit. Throw the ball down in the zone, get the ground balls, and just get outs that way, because you're not going to get this team to swing and miss.
Yeah, I looked up these numbers before the show, and they would worry me if I was a Mets fan. So sorry, Chris, but I think there might be some potentially bad news, because, you know, Harvey and DeGrom only combined for four strikeouts in their 11 innings of work. And in the postseason, Harvey's been striking out 23% of the batters he's faced, and DeGrom a little higher at 27%. So those two guys that relied on the strikeout, DeGrom obviously more so than Harvey. And I don't want to say Harvey got knocked around, but neither pitcher was up to our expectations. And in the postseason, Syndergaard has been relying on the strikeout even more heavily than the first two pitchers. His K per nine in the postseason has been 13.85, and the strikeout percentage is 38.5%. And so if the Royals aren't going to strike out, you wonder how Syndergaard is going to get these guys out.
He's not DeGrom in the sense that DeGrom has 4+ pitches that he can use. But, you know, Syndergaard can throw 99-100, and the Royals hit pitches that fast very well. But you have, you know, a curveball that's really good, a change that's good. He can use those three pitches, and I don't think the Mets are going to have to live and die by striking out 7-8 guys a game. I just think they need to get the Royals off balance. You know, they're a fastball-hitting team, and they're just going to keep the line moving and hitting singles. So if you can just knock them off balance just once or twice, I think it can really change the way that they approach the at-bats, and that's going to be key for the Mets, is just get them off their game a little bit, and that's going to be the key. The bigger issue, I think, and I think Mets fans will agree with this, is the fact that the offense is just non-existent. And, again, I mentioned this on the podcast last night, that the Mets have played two types of games. The first 8.5 innings of game one and the 14 or so innings since then. The 8.5 innings of game one, where they just looked like they were on, they were locked in at the plate, they would be able to score runs. I mean, they were two outs away from a 1-0 lead in this series. I mean, that's how close they were. They were pitching well. The bullpen came through. Familia, you went to him, he was lights out. You had faith that he was going to get it done. And they scored enough runs to win. Four runs was enough. It didn't work out the way they planned, and they had to go to extras. But since that time, they let Chris Young absolutely embarrass them, and then they got embarrassed by a very good Johnny Cueto last night. So they're going to have to change what they're doing at the plate. I don't know what it is, but they just got to fix that. And if they score runs, I think they have a chance, no matter how good or bad the pitching is. Because if they can get the offense going, I think they're okay with winning 7-6 games.
Yeah, I mean, I think they'd be okay just winning in general.
Right, yeah. I mean, they'll take a win any way they can get it, if it's 2-1 or if it's 9-8, you know. If they can score runs, they think they have a chance.
And Ventura's a good pitcher, but the way to get him off his game is to piss him off. I mean, you just got to get him off kilter as much as possible. Because when he starts getting in his own head, he starts getting a little wild, and then the Mets can go to work on him. So they got to do everything they can, you know, take time out, step out of the box, do anything you can just to get his timing off, and the Mets can go to work on him.
I think a huge point for the Mets is if Syndergaard can come out tomorrow night and get three outs in the first, and they can get two runs at home, because it'll do one of two things. It will do two things, excuse me. One, it will get that Citi Field crowd energetic, and that's going to be huge. And secondly, it's going to prove to themselves that, okay, we can score runs against these guys. We can do this. We can be locked in at the plate. And then from there, you just got to play the game, you know? 2-0 is not the worst thing in the world. You got three games at home. They protected home field in their stadium. You protect home field in yours, and you just try to steal one on the road. And that's all you can ask for.
No, and I think that the Mets are far from dead. I mean, 2-0 is a bad hole to be in. But, I mean, they got to the World Series, right? I mean, and this is the horse that they rode in, so they're going to live and die by it. I mean, I've heard some talk about Mets fans wanting to move David Wright down in the order, or they want to put Uribe in. And in my mind, I mean, this is the lineup, and you got to go to work with it. And you hope that Cespedes' shoulder isn't part of the issue. You hope a lot of things. But I like the Mets' chances. I mean, the Royals statistically right now have a better shot, but I think they can win the Syndergaard game. And they just got to beat Chris Young is what it is, because he shut them down the first game in. And they need Steven Matz to give him 5 or 6 innings on the next game.
Yeah, I mean, if they can get it 2-2 going to Game 5 with a Harvey start, I think all the talk of what happened in Kansas City goes away. You know,
absolutely.
The Alcides Escobar inside the park homer to start the World Series, the 14 inning game, getting destroyed by Cueto, all of it goes away if they're 2-2 in a Game 5 with Matt Harvey on the mound. It all goes away, and that's the beauty of playoff baseball in a 7-game series. You can make all that early stuff go away. They just got to get the job done, and on paper they have the pitching matchups that they wanted. You know, in Game 1 and 2, you could say that they got who they wanted out there, but they faced the Royals' best. They faced Edison Volquez, who's been really good in the playoffs, and they faced Johnny Cueto, who hasn't been great in the playoffs, but is capable of being really, really good. So they now have the two matchups that they want. They just got to get it done, and I think they will. I think this will be 2-2 before we know it.
And Matt Harvey with the Citi Field crowd behind him is scary.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing. If they can get the crowd going in Game 3, that could give them some momentum for the other three games there. So let me. I have a question for both of you. Do you see the series going past 6 games?
I don't think so. Honestly, the Royals are just so they're not great anywhere, and I almost feel bad saying that just because, you know, Alex Gordon is such a good left fielder. You know, Escobar is playing so well right now, and you know, but when you look at the Royals, you don't see like a superstar really at any position, but they're so solid up and down the line that they don't really have any holes, and their defense is so suffocating that, you know, those little bloop singles that you kind of look for to make or break, you know, a couple run rally or help put up a crooked number just don't happen when you're playing a team like Kansas City, and they're just so solid. They're so much better than last year. It came to me while I was watching the game that this team would have just run through the 2014 Giants team. And so I think the Royals are going to take it home this year.
Yeah. I originally, before the series started, I said Mets in 7, but at the same time, I mean, 2-0, like I said, 2-0 is a rough hole to get out of. And as much as I like the odds for the Syndergaard game and the Harvey game, the Mets game scares me a little bit. I mean, this is a tough series to force all the way. Maybe the Mets go on and win their next four. Who knows? And so, no, it doesn't get past game seven, and it's a six-game thing. But I don't know. I mean, it's very, very hard to get to game seven right now.
I also wonder how much of an effect it will have that the Royals for the next three games will not have a DH.
Yeah, they're not going to put Kendrys Morales in the field, right?
I would assume they're not. I mean, and they could very much prove me wrong, but I don't know where he would play. You're not going to take Hosmer out of the lineup, are you?
No.
So, I mean, they're going to play without Morales, and that's a big weapon in their lineup. And the pitcher's got to hit. So, I mean, that's two things in the Mets' favor, and, you know, the Mets are used to playing that way, and they'll take advantage of it. You hope they would, you know.
Devil's advocate. Chris Young spent some time in the National League, and Johnny Cueto spent most of his career in the National League, so it's not like they're absolutely clueless up there. I mean, they're pitchers, but I don't know.
Well, they wouldn't have – would they have Cueto?
Oh, that's right. No, I'm being silly right now. Volquez spent time in the National League is what I meant.
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, but Chris Young spent some time in the National League. I would rather take Volquez over Young in the batter's box. But they got Ventura, you know, so I think it all evens out. It's going to be different for them, definitely. Well, all right. I think that'll do it. Did we miss anything, guys? Did we cover all that we wanted to cover today?
I think so.
I'm sure something happened while we were on the show and we missed it. I'm sure it happened. This is what always happens to us, Matt. We always get done and we're like, oh, we forgot this.
I'm sure the comments will tell you.
They normally would, yeah. So, Nick, thank you for joining us. We hope to do this again. Our pleasure. We hope to have you again sometime. Matt, as always, thank you for coming on.
No problem.
And hopefully we can get Mike Bates back on the show at some point, because he's the hot takes guy, and we kind of need him on the show. If he's listening, Mike, we need you back. I don't know. I don't think he's listening, but whatever. So, all right, guys, thanks for joining us, and we will see you guys next week for episode 6. We're gonna live with this being 5, and if it's not, we're just
gonna... It is. I checked.
Oh, you checked. Okay, so yes, this was episode 5. So thank you for joining us, and we will see you for episode 6.